This chair reminds me of a little incident I tell about in the book when I was a radio actor and was rehearsing for a serial production of Treasure Island, and I was sitting in an old office chair in the studio, and the director said, "What's that noise?" And we finally narrowed it down to the old oak desk chair that I was sitting in, and he said, "Let's keep that in." And so all through the series, I or some other actor who wasn't actually on mic, ran 13 weeks or something, sat in that desk chair and creaked to make the creaking of the Hispaniola's rigging in the, as she sailed along whenever the sea scenes.
Well, it works.
Yeah.
I remember when I went off to college in the mid-1950s, first thing I saw when I went to the college radio station was a sound effects board, and it was on rollers,
and
so they could roll it from studio to studio.
Yeah.
And they don't make those anymore.
No. But it's amazing what, when they do use sound effects, what they can do now with recordings, how they can call stuff up instantly, fingertips.
They probably use synthesizers, don't they?
I don't know, but it's all at fingertip control.
I was doing a television pilot about 2 years ago. It never went anywhere. About books, of course. I'd been so long out of television. I was in television in Baltimore before I came up to New York, but been in radio for so long, I'd almost forgotten that there had been tremendous technological strides.
Oh, yeah.
And so they could produce almost any sound.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You wanted musical bridges. I mean, the guy was punched through a little computer, and all these bridges would come through.
Yeah, just amazing.
And I said, "Dude, that didn't happen. We had phonograph records.
Yeah.
We really did.
Yeah.
Some of them were 78s that we used."
Yeah.
Well, it's great to having you here. And, in fact, Turnabout is fair play, since your other half was here with his one-eyed Mac.
Yeah.
Last year, and so when are you going to tackle a novel?
Very soon. I have it very advanced in the planning. This book has released me, I think, from a lot of inhibitions I had. I notice you have the right place at the right time under there. That was a much colder book. It was written at more distance and deliberately that way. I didn't want myself personally involved, my emotions personally involved in it. I just wanted as much sort of ironic distance as I could keep from the material. I thought it was appropriate to the material because I thought it was very pretentious to be writing an autobiography at 50, which is when that was being written. And I think the personal material, autobiographical material, which crept up on me almost unawares in Wordstruck. I didn't set out to write that as a memoir. I set out to write a book about how I found pleasure in the language, and I thought it would be a lot more sort of analyzing bits of Shakespeare or T.S. Eliot and that kind of thing, and technical analysis of the stuff, and what I, as an amateur, not a scholar, found delight in. But it became necessary almost immediately in order to find the origins of that, as I say, to snoop around in my childhood, and then that got interesting. And then
I wondered what
then portraits first. Then portraits of my parents began to emerge little by little, and quite painfully at first. And then, as I added more detail, and suddenly I had a kind of like a blockage in an artery removed. There was a rush, a gush of memory, and I was able to use it all. And then it was a question of balancing the how much autobiographical stuff to put in or take out to keep a balance with the other material. And I had more in, and between me and the editor, we kept altering the balance a little bit back and forth.
Well,
to answer your question, two things have happened. I think I've kind of opened a little bit of a door to my unconscious in a way that I think is necessary to be creative that had closed long ago when I gave up trying to write plays and books for journalism. And I think it's opened again, and I'm in the middle of a play now, and I haven't written a play for 25 years. But that's what I set out to do, long ago, and fell into journalism. And I'm a very long way along in planning a novel, which I have confidence will work. I don't know why. I just think it'll work. I think I can write it now. And also, I think I've discovered, as I say at the end of this book, I think I've discovered what to write about. I was one of that generation of Canadians, which I am, as I say there, who felt that everything literary was happening somewhere else, either in the States or in Britain. It sure wasn't happening in Canada as far as we could see. And so we got out. And now I think, a generation later, when there is such a volume of Canadian literature and Canada is a place to write about, which it didn't seem to be in my naive days, younger days, I recognize that if I'd stayed, had the patience to stay, or just left for a while and gone back to where I grew up and written about those people, I would have been closer to my own material, to my own roots, and that I, in effect, kind of cut myself off from my roots, creatively speaking. And it was a phrase in a novel by Robertson Davies that made me realize that about 5 or 6 years ago. So, when am I going to try a novel? As soon as I finish the play, in other words, this summer.
I think that as you write, every writer takes on more risk. Obviously, this was a more journalistic approach to writing.
Yeah.
Although Wordstrom makes a very nice companion piece because it sets the tone as the events leading up.
It's kind of prequel, as somebody called it. Well, it's an interesting thing you say about as one writes more, one takes more risks. The writer takes more risks. I never put that together before, but it's an interesting thought.
Well, you gain confidence in what you're doing as a writer, and two, you seek new goals, new highs, and
and you're not as afraid of, perhaps, as of course this depends on the individual, not as afraid of yourself as you were.
Well, when you your early writing, you do reveal yourself to a degree. As one writes, everyone reveals himself in his writing, including fiction, no matter how disguised a person's life is revealed in that writing. But as time goes on, I think he reveals himself even more because he becomes less afraid to do it. You've gone so far, you might as well go a little further.
Yeah.
And so each episode builds on the other.
Not only that, but I think patterns start to emerge, which are almost the writer's unconscious falling into grooves or falling into little kind of emotional ditches, which are part of him, which he may not even be aware of, and critics and other readers can point it out. We are using that, at least that theory, as a basis for a series we've just begun to work on, the same team that made The Story of English, a series about Shakespeare. Now, and it's about Shakespeare the man, not sort of primarily about the plays, poems, but very little is known about Shakespeare as a man. And the absence of material about him, of course, has given rise to the enormous speculation and almost the sort of sub-industry of just trying to discover who he might have been if he wasn't the guy from Warwickshire. But I believe the theory, I just believe it emotionally and I intuitively, that Shakespeare, in fact, reveals himself a great deal in the plays, that there's a consistency to certain threads and certain threads of characters and performance, the personality that comes through. Certain parts of the sensibility that repeat themselves and are quite at odds with the reigning sensibility of the age. So there's something very distinctive there. Anyway, we're using that to work on the Shakespeare series.
Well, I interviewed an awful lot of writers, including Robertson Davies, which was here last month, in fact, Margaret Atwood, a lot of Canadian writers. But everybody tells me that writing fiction is tough. It's not only is it tough to write, sometimes it's very tough to sell. I don't think you're going to have any problem with your name recognition, but for many people, it's a matter of frustration to be able to write, and some people hate it. They just hate writing fiction, but they do it. I guess it's something within us that we have to tell stories.
I like telling stories.
Yeah. I also you mentioned a moment ago that you felt that in your younger days, Canadian artists felt they had to get out. Somehow, I see Canada at that time was much like the American Midwest.
Yeah.
Midwesterners have that same feeling. I'm from the Midwest, and we all felt that we had to leave.
I know. There's a great analogy. I mean, there was a sense of provincialism in Canada, that that you were sort of irredeemably disconnected from where it was at. And people from small towns in America felt the same thing, and they had to get to New York or get to Chicago, or get to where it was happening, or get to Paris in the 20s or 30s.
And we did, most of us.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the things in Wordstruck. I think how you have interrelated your love of language and words was done very, very well because there was a reason for it.
Yeah.
It wasn't just stuck in there. But in the very first chapter, you talk about your love of books and of the early writers that you read. Tell the radio audience a little bit how this love of books came about.
Well, it came about because I was fortunate enough to have a mother who loved reading. It was during the Depression years when there wasn't a lot else they could afford to do, and my father was away most of the time. He was at sea. And he was a great book collector, an avid reader. Books were an important part of our furniture and interior decoration. When he was at home, and he and my mother were at home, that was one of their chief diversions, to read. And so books were a part of the sort of emotional and physical fabric of our lives from the very beginning.
Isn't it true that you could virtually chart your father's career through the...
That's right, because I inherited most of his books, except his service books, which went to my brother, who was in the Navy. But I can, because he always wrote wherever he bought a book and wherever he was when he got it. He wrote in it. So I can tell what he was reading at various times in his life, which, since he died quite young, has helped me to know him a great deal better. And it was a pre-television childhood, which makes, I think, a big difference, because it's not impossible to get children to read or to read to them now, but it's much harder. You have to kind of rip their eyeballs away from the set. And television is very much more seductive than books for young children of this generation and the previous. There was no television then, and there was relatively little radio in my earliest days. That gradually crept up on us in the late 30s and early 40s.
I see you were exposed to a lot of the American
radio. Oh, sure. Radio. Oh, sure. I grew up. I mean, Woody Allen's radio days spoke to me. But, you know, it disappointed me because as brilliant as Allen is, radio is such a personal thing that everyone of that generation had his own radio days and somebody else's images, while they may coincide here and there, don't necessarily coincide with somebody else's. In my case, they didn't altogether. Radio is such a medium so stimulating to the imagination. I mean, there's a whole chapter in my book about radio.
At least it was stimulating. I'm not sure it is today.
Well, I mean, it still has the potential of stimulating. I mean, people listening to something as simple as the news on WCBS, which I do all the time, have each listener creates in his mind a sense of who the people are who he hears regularly. And he weaves fantasies around them. And that's stimulating to the imagination. I have all kinds of ideas of the personas of the different, what they look like and how old they are and everything else. And you can be wildly wrong. But it is, it does make you imagine. And stories told on the radio, every listener to a story on the radio will paint a different scene for it and clothe the people differently and give them different physiognomies and so on, which you can't do on television. Television's very... in a funny way, a very literal medium, and not stimulating to the imagination.
No, it's not. Who were some of the early authors that you read?
Well, they were the standard authors for a child with a very strong English influence. And so it was Robert Louis Stevenson's Child's Garden of Verses, and of course, nursery rhymes and things, and the A.A. Milne books, Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh and all that. Peter Pan, Water Babies, Wind in the Willows, Tom Sawyer, quite young, and Huck Finn. My favorite book ever, and still, Treasure Island, Stevenson's Treasure Island, which for some reason I admired young and still do much more than I ever did Kidnapped or The Master of Ballantrae, which I appreciated a little later in life. Let me see, and Dickens. These were all books that were read to me. Little Men, Little Women. But all those were books I read to me, and, Gulliver's Travels, The Jungle Books, Robinson Crusoe. I guess that's all the books that were read to me, and some Dickens, David Copperfield, Great Expectations, Oliver Twist. Books that were far more sophisticated in their vocabulary and general sort of literary quality than a kid of 6 or 7 or 8 is capable of reading. And I was not a precocious reader myself. I think probably because I was read to so much and so effectively, it was very nice. So those were the earliest, earliest books that formed my sort of feeling for story,
yes,
literature,
and
words.
So it's certainly not surprising that you would develop this love of language that you had.
Yeah, I think having an element, I'm not really qualified, except in my own personal experience, to talk about this. I'm not a linguist, I'm not a scholar, I'm not an expert on child development or anything, so I don't know, but I guess, and I emotionally feel it's true, that having an element of poetry in there early helps create a love of words, which may not become conscious for many years. In my case, I didn't really become aware of it until my late teens, and I hit Shakespeare, or Shakespeare hit me like this great revelation, like something going off in my head. But having been read, for instance, the poems in A Child's Garden of Verses, or the A.A. Milne poems, the When We Were Very Young and Now We Are Six, and those things, which are wonderful poems. They're very funny. They're full of satire. They're full of very strong rhythms and repetitions. They're just as good as, and as funny as the Dr. Seuss poems, and a little more consistent and predictable in their rhythms and rhymes than his are. I think that helps create a feeling for language, because there's a heightened emotional and rhythmic quality that goes with rhythmic recitation. Going back to the oral tradition, in the days when the storyteller was often the shaman or the priest or the wise man, and also the custodian of the history of the clan and the group, the way that history was passed on from generation to generation, there being no writing, it had all to be memorized, and frequently in many cultures it was memorized with rhythmic elements in it, in the form of the sagas or the epics that came down through Greek culture to be actually written down by Homer, the Icelandic sagas and the Beowulf, Finnish, wonderful Finnish saga that was only discovered really in modern times, although the oral tradition had kept it alive until the middle of the 19th century, the Kalevala, the Land of Heroes, all depended on people being able to retain thousands of verses, and they did that by having, or thousands of stanzas, they did that by having a rhythmic element which aids memory, and I think that has something to do with creating the earliest layers of an appreciation for words and stories.
Yeah, well, when I was
it's very primitive, but important.
Yeah, they made us memorize and recite poetry, but I, following this line that you suggested, I cheated. I always would select Poe. Very easy to remember.
Yeah,
it's not surprising. What do you suppose that people like yourself and Robertson Davies had such difficulty with math?
Well, it's funny. I didn't really. I know what you're referring to. I was intended to go into the Navy, and in those days, to get into the Naval College in Canada, you had to write a whole set of exams in addition to your high school graduation, and I flunked the algebra exam, and I didn't get into the Navy, which was wonderful luck for the Navy, and in the end, good for me. But normally, I could do all right in math. I was better in science, but I could do all right. I think it was just some unconscious psychological block which told me that I could shut off that route, because I could get along all right. I don't dislike mathematics. In fact, I rather enjoy it. I wasn't a whiz at it. I was much better at languages and chemistry and things like that. But I don't know. I think an awful lot's to do with the way it's taught and the atmosphere around it.
Well, Davies hated it, and in fact, when he was going to the university in Ontario, he couldn't pass. He couldn't get his degree, so his parents shipped him off to Oxford, where they didn't require mathematics to graduate.
Yeah.
And I like that. I mean, I guess it's desirable to have mathematics in your background, but I hardly ever use it. I have a calculator now on a computer, and most of that dirty work is done for me.
You're just not supposed to say that nowadays, so that young people can hear it, because I think it's unfortunate that we have allowed, you know, the stuff that C.P. Snow wrote about in the series of novels, the Corridors of Power, this idea of allowing, which came out of the British universities, Oxford and Cambridge particularly, but our culture has picked it up, that somehow the liberal arts are separate from, in modern times, science and mathematics. Dividing science off from the other humanities, I think, is a great mistake. I think it's quite easy to achieve scientific and mathematical literacy alongside formal literacy with a little sympathetic teaching and understanding of it. It is, I think it's going to be very, very dangerous for this country, for the Western world, if we do not keep our science and maths up there as part of the general culture. We can't let computers and calculators take it all. If you have to understand.
If you say so. I'm going to stick to my calculator. One thing you wrote that surprised me, that Canada looked toward Great Britain and not to the United States during the time that you
were. Well, certainly the part of Canada I grew up in, Nova Scotia. As I say, it's one time zone closer to England than the rest of North America, and it was like decades closer psychologically at that time. It was still very much at that time, psychologically or culturally, a British colony. Other parts of Canada weren't as much so. If you went to the prairie provinces at that time, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, you wouldn't have found that. And there are always stronger ties, North and South Canada, U.S., at various points, East and West, than there are East and West. But it just happened that way. And it was partly to do with who my parents were and who their friends were and what their interests were. But that was very much true in my case. We looked that way rather than down here.
Of course, you did a good portion of your family was from the United States.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And two of my four grandparents were. Yeah.
Are you still a Canadian?
Yeah, I am. Mm-hmm.
Your early days in radio, you were in Halifax.
But as I say at the very last line of the book, I found this wonderful quote from Joseph Brodsky. I feel I am a citizen of the great English language. In the Canada I grew up in, a sense of nationality and nationalism was much weaker than it is now. I interviewed John Kenneth Galbraith once, who grew up as a Canadian, and he said, I grew up with a very thin sense of nationalism. Well, so did I. And I found that I felt at home in other parts of the English-speaking world, in fact, in parts of the non-English-speaking world, just as much as I did in Canada. And I do here. And I did in Britain. I lived a long time in Britain.
Your early days in radio, I believe they started in Halifax.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, it started with Shakespeare. I was in a production of Shakespeare at college as a freshman, and a producer from the CBC came backstage and asked me if I wanted to act on the radio, and did I. And they did a lot of live radio drama at the time, and so I did quite a lot of that, and then that led to some announcing. And then later on, when I moved to Ottawa and went back to college, I did all kinds of announcing. I did a year as an all-night disc jockey, in addition to radio acting. I had a part in a daily radio serial for nearly a year while I was doing the all-night disc jockey. I've done control room operating. I've done, you know, editing. I've worked in newsroom. I've done classical music program. I did most of the things, as you know what it was like in small radio stations. You could do everything. You had to do everything because they had very few bodies around. They let you do everything. When I was 20 or 21, the radio station I worked for in Ottawa, part-time and full-time, depending on when it was, while I was still going to college, on Sunday mornings, they had me writing a commentary on the week's news, a sort of review of the week's news with a kind of interpretive commentary. And here I was, absolutely wet kid of 21, knowing nothing, and airing all my prejudices with a great air as though I really knew what I was doing. I didn't become a journalist until several years later when I went to work for a news agency for 5 years, but in London. But I did all that stuff in radio.
But you did do early television broadcasting.
I was by my last year in college.
You have a wonderful story in here about doing an interview with two Canadian officials and forgetting their names.
Oh yeah, I'm terrible with names, and still am. I got a job finally, and I was slowly finishing my degree part-time with the CBC as a staff network announcer. And then they opened the first television station in Ottawa, and so I became one of the announcers for that. And I became the first one to do, as they called it, an outside broadcast or a remote. That's the story you're referring to, when they had the Ottawa Valley Exhibition, and it was like a state fair. And they did, for the first time, they were going to cover it on television with a mobile unit. And I stood in front of the mobile unit to open the show with a lollipop mic and said, "Good evening. We're fortunate to bring you the first ever telecast of the Ottawa Valley Exhibition. We're fortunate to have with us the man who has made this great cultural event from this region possible for the last 27 years, Mr. I'm terribly sorry, but I've forgotten your name." And he told me, and I started to interview him. And then while I was interviewing him, I realized that the man standing on my other side, who was his assistant, I was going to have to turn to an interview to, and I couldn't remember his name either. And I kept spinning out the first interview, trying desperately to think of his name, and I couldn't, until finally the stage director waved me over to the other one. And I said, "Well, thank you very much, sir, and now we are lucky to have your assistant. You're not going to believe this, but I've forgotten your name, too." And he believed it.
Well,
ever since then, I've had... If I'm interviewing anybody, I've had the name of that person written down somewhere. And, of course, the act of writing it down puts it in your head, but whether it's on a shirt cuff or on a piece of paper in your pocket or somewhere. But I still forget people's names on our nightly program.
But you handled that well. You admitted that you didn't know the name. You had no other choice, actually. But I remember coming back from stories or being on the telephone doing a news story with the anchor in the studio, and he would ask me a question about the story and covering, and I don't know the answer. The first time that happened to me, I began to think about, well, I can make it up. I could, but I just can't say I don't know. Mm-hmm. But then I decided, well, I would.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bob, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll check it and get back to you, or something like that. Yeah. So it seemed to me that that's probably the best way of handling it when you're on the
phone. Boy, is that good advice. If there is one piece of advice I give to, when I'm asked for, which isn't all the time, for the young staff we have, it is, if you don't know, say you don't know. You get into so much trouble. I was once working as a network correspondent for NBC, and they trotted us around a group of correspondents to various places like the Economic Club of Detroit, where we all made little talks, and then they asked us questions. And I was covering Goldwater at the time. And a question came from the floor about a series of books that sort of were the emotional, political atmosphere, background to the Goldwater campaign, and one was None Dare Call It Treason. And the man asked the question in such a way that I felt embarrassed to admit that I hadn't read the book. And I kind of faked it and got it wrong. And I don't think anybody particularly noticed, but I felt so privately humiliated that I was really bloody silly to be embarrassed about something I didn't know. It's far better to say I didn't know.
It's interesting that in your early days as an announcer, this was not atypical in the United States either. In fact, I worked for the CBS television affiliate in Baltimore, and they used staff announcers.
Yeah.
We would prepare the news, and some of us would do some reporting, but they had staff announcers.
Yes, with voices.
That's right.
Now, here is the news.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that changed, of course. I mean, by the mid-60s, they began to realize that people, there were broadcasters who were also journalists sometimes. And this changed, but it really was tough.
I actually
worked with a staff announcer.
I actually prepared news for a while in a radio station in Ottawa for a man who read the news with a whole thing with one hand behind his ear, in the way they joke about announcers doing so they can hear the resonance of their own voice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he read the whole newscast with one hand up like this.
Well, you write in the book that...
Which would be hard to do on television.
Right. You write that at the CBC they were shocked when you pulled up stakes and decided to go to London. Why did you... You had a... potential great career there, a network. Why did you make this change?
Well, I really always fancied myself, after I'd given up the idea of being an actor, which I had the luck to do quite early, I decided I wanted to be a writer, which I think I'd really known all along. And what I really wanted to write was plays, or thought I could write at the time, with sort of novels as a second thing. And because I'd worked all through college, I had saved the huge sum of $2,000, which was a lot of money in 1955. And I thought I could support myself for a while on that. So I headed off for London, got my degree, and left on the boat. And thought, you know, I thought I was doing like all the Hemingways and other people and the F. Scott Fitzgeralds and everybody had done in the 20s and 30s. They went to Europe, only I went to London first. I was going to crash into the West End Theater and write the big hit plays. Well, I wrote a lot of plays, and I went through the money fairly fast, and I wanted to get married. And my prospective father-in-law had the rather old-fashioned idea that his daughter should marry someone who had gainful employment. And so I became a journalist. I needed a job, and I fell into that.
And
I continued to write in the evenings and early mornings through most of the 50s, and I came very close to getting a play produced at the Royal Court in London. Close. The committee who read it divided two and two to do it, not to do it, and because they were divided, they didn't do it. But I got quite a lot of encouragement. But I just then, journalism got a lot more interesting. I got picked up by NBC in London and was traveling all the time, all over Europe and Africa and the Middle East, all the trouble spots, and that was thrilling. It was during the height of the Cold War. I was in all kinds of neat places. And that sort of stuff is so exciting and so energy-consuming and so consuming of the same juices you use, I think, to write, that there just wasn't any psychic room.
Yeah. I wouldn't give up on those plays. Your colleague Jim has had a couple of plays produced.
Yeah, I know. We've
Georgia, right?
Yes, he had a staged reading here in New York, and he had a play produced at the Kennedy Center and at the Eudora Welty New Playwrights Theater in Jackson, and he's writing a screenplay now for his novel, which was published last year. Which is only the first of his. He's written the sequel, and the sequel to the sequel, and the third sequel to the all about the same character.
Are you guys in competition? He writes a book, you write a book?
Well, his wife, who's also a novelist, and I compare notes sometimes. I mean, Lair's like a machine. I said once in an interview that he's really like an old-fashioned drugstore soda fountain. I mean, in the they had levers there that you'd get chocolate syrup or lemon or raspberry or something, and Lehrer's got one lever for journalism and another one for novels and another one for plays, and he can turn one off and one on as easily as you can put a squirt of chocolate syrup on a sundae. I mean, it's just amazing. He has a mind that, I mean, if he has half an hour to spare in the office, he rolls up the other part of the file on his computer, and we'll write another scene in a play or another 20 pages in a novel, which I can't do.
This was a terrific series. I interviewed Crumb when he was here. What role did you play in the creation of this book? I think he did most of the writing in this book.
He did most of the writing. I did some of the writing. I don't know mathematically how much. I know where the parts are that I wrote, and I did a very heavy editing job, and then we had all three of us collaborated on the making of the series from the very beginning of the series. The series was McCrum's idea in the first place, but we had all three worked very closely.
What came first, the series or the book?
Simultaneous. As a program was finished in the series, a chapter in the book was drafted, and of and from and in addition to the television scripts, and I wrote a lot of the television script too. So, it was the most wonderful thing I've ever done on television. More fun, and as you can tell from Wordstruck, it was a labor of love.
Yes.
And the same team is now working on this series, or hoping to produce a series on Shakespeare.
How is your ear for regionalisms? Here in New York, we'll hear someone from the South, two people from the South. They all sound alike, but there are shades of differences between one region and the South.
Yeah, they get sharp when I'm exposed to them fresh. And if I spend a few days in Charleston, South Carolina, then I'm tuned in a bit to Charleston. If I spend a few days in Dallas, I can begin to hear that again, or Chicago. I can't sit and reproduce them myself, but I recognize them when I hear them. But it needs a little bit of... I am not an expert on this, and I'm not sure that I have a sharply refined enough ear. I can recognize about 6 or 7 of the regional dialects in England, beyond Cockney, which is obvious. But also I lived long enough in London and loved Cockney that I could recognize some variations in Cockney, but not.
I think McCormick mentioned, or maybe it's in the book, I can't remember now, that there are more dialects in England than there are in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's true.
It's so small.
Yeah. And, of course, it was those dialects that gave rise to the dialects in this country. I mean, one of the most exciting moments in the series to me was we have Peter Hall, one of the famous producers of Shakespeare in Britain, talking about how Shakespeare himself might have sounded, given his presumed Warwickshire background. And he says Shakespeare himself might have said the opening speech from Henry V something like, "Oh, what a muse of foyer, so to ascend the brightest heaven of invention." And he says how hard it is to get to work with modern British actors who speak Southern Educated English, or BBC English, who clip the vowels and reduce the number of syllables and say things like military, which Shakespeare would never have done because it's military. But anyway, a few moments in the series after that, you hear that, we go into the Chesapeake Bay, and by boat you go into Tangier Island in the middle of Chesapeake Bay, and you hear voiceover, the voice of a preacher in a church on Tangier Island. And damned if it isn't this. It's so close to the accent you've just heard Peter Hall imitating from Warwickshire that it is uncanny. And, of course, the Tidewater English, the Hoytoiders, as they're called in Virginia and Maryland, are the descendants of fishermen from Devon and Cornwall who had shared much of that kind of West Country speech, the speech of Sir Walter Raleigh and so on. It was one of those moments that gave you a little shiver because you realized that there are living fossils of language.
One thing that has bothered me, and it's a phenomenon, I think, that can't be completely explained, this generation of new actors, people like Sean Penn and Michael J. Fox, they don't sound like anybody. Who will the comedians who would imitate people like Cagney and Bogart? You can't imitate these people. They all have high-pitched voices. They have no distinct sound. Have you noticed that?
I guess I notice it as part of the general sort of androgyny in pop singing more than I notice it in movies. Fox is Canadian, isn't he?
I don't know.
I think he is.
But he doesn't sound any different than any of the other young actors.
Yeah.
You just listen to the soundtrack, and I don't think you can tell one from the other.
But I think there is something in the entertainment factory these days that stupidly, I think in the long run, attempts to create a kind of generalized wit, a generalized sense of drama that will appeal to everybody and be relatively regionless and non-distinctive. One of the most pathetic things happens when Canadians produce television series, or they're produced by American companies that go to Canada because it's cheaper there and they get tax benefits and so on, and then produce them with no sense of real background, so that they're anonymous cities and anonymous characters.
Toronto has become every city.
Every city, yeah. And so I don't know whether that's part of it. But that's why the Australian movies were so successful, I think, the early ones, because they clearly came with a kind of reek and stamp of Australia on them. And here was something so authentically ethnic and identifiable, and its humor grew out of its own culture. I think it was just a wonderful, refreshing breeze through. But the mass market doesn't. If you look at even a successful film like Moonstruck, made by a Canadian director. A lot of it shot in Toronto. It happens that a restaurant I like to go to very much in New York, the Gran Ticino, where I've been going for 25 years, an old Italian restaurant in the village, they use that as the setting for the encounters of Cher and Cher's mother in the movie. It is shot in Toronto, shot in a studio in Toronto.
Well, Robert McNeil, I don't think we'll ever run out of things to talk about. Sure, we could keep going on and on. I know you have other appointments and things to do. You have a show to do tonight, too. I would.
And as a matter of fact, I don't, because I'm off for 2 weeks while I do this. It's a holiday.
That's good for you. I really enjoyed Wordstruck, and there were moving passages, and your relationship with your father, and the story of your mother. And these were all not only interesting, but moving, and particularly the parts where you describe your love of language and give examples of the words and how they've changed. Very nicely done, and I'm certainly going to look forward to that novel. Put it right up next to Layers.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.